kept locking up the jury. The jury kept saying, we're going to find the same verdict. And finally, in the case of Edward Bushell, one of the jurors, it was taken to a higher court, and the higher court finally said, you can't penalize a jury for a decision. You can, you know, you can't, the jury has the right to say guilty or not guilty. That's the basic Magna Carta. That's the basic right of every English citizen in the great British Empire. I have a lot of bad things to say about the British Empire, but the jury system is a good thing that came out of the British Empire, in my view. So, anyway, Godfrey Lehman wrote a book about Edward Bushell. He wrote a book about jury nullification, and we cornered him in a cafe in San Francisco, and you're now going to hear an interview with Godfrey Lehman. It's important for homeless people for a number of reasons. There are state laws that homeless people are accused of violating at different places, such as the so-called infamous anti-lodging law, an old 1871 law, which Sacramento police and Santa Ana police and even San Francisco police have charged homeless people with, which makes it a misdemeanor to sleep, but they call it lodging. If you're in a public area, you're using their public space for lodging by lying down and sleeping. I was arrested under this law in 1990 in a protest in San Francisco, and we fought it back, not by finding the law unconstitutional, which I would suspect it is, but judges won't find it so, but because so many of us were charged with this, they decided they didn't want to provide 20 jury trials on that issue, and also it was a protest, so they thought the best thing to do was to shovel it under the rug. But wherever misdemeanors are charged, you have a right to a jury trial. And so homeless people can take jury trials, as, for example, they're doing in Santa Barbara, and as they can do in other places here, for example, if you're charged with failure to appear, that is a misdemeanor. Don't let Judge Mulligan tell you otherwise. He's lying. It's a misdemeanor, not an infraction. And they cannot reduce a misdemeanor to an infraction without your consent. So say, I don't want this charge reduced to an infraction. I want a jury trial. I want a public defender. And I'll be talking a little bit about this, the sleeping ban organizing, if I have some time to do it later today at 4 o'clock at the Coffee Roasting Company, if people want to be there to chat on this issue. But jury nullification is really important, and homeless people do face jury trials. Panhandling can be charged as a misdemeanor and is in this city, as is public intoxication. If they want to get people who are drunk out of the downtown, there's the standard approach of the city the new judges is they will find someone guilty and of a misdemeanor and then impose a probation condition that says you have to stay away from downtown. Well, you might say, gosh, that keeps the drunks out of the downtown. What's wrong with that? Well, my view is if a person's drunk and they're behaving inappropriately and abusively, yes, they should be held accountable for their behavior, though homeless people, I might say, are a special case, because they don't have homes they can go get drunk in, and there is a problem, and cops seek them out in other areas. But if someone's being abusive and drunk, whatever, that's something that shouldn't be allowed. However, just to debar someone from the whole area, whether you're drunk or sober for a year, because you have been drunk, is an incredible abuse that essentially is sort of a homeless cleansing measure used by our courts. That's wrong. Has to be stopped. Shouldn't be allowed. And one way we short-circuit this process is going in at the misdemeanor level where there's a jury trial and educating jurors about their right to just say no to eager prosecutors who want to bust people for marijuana, even bust people for heroin use, bust people for public drunkenness. And it's not a question of whether the man or the woman is drunk or the man or the woman is using heroin. It's a question of what are the prosecutors going to do with this? Are they what's the general policy being used here? What is the real objectives? And to me, you have a whole set of supports of class legislation. And juries can say no to that. And they don't have to. Everyone doesn't have to say no, just one person. And let's hear what Godfrey had to say about this as we cornered the rascal in it was a Japanese cafe. It's a fairly lengthy interview. We may interrupt it before the end because we may want to move on to something else, or I may just have to get out of here, but I'll be playing the rest of it later. And you can always call in during the show, even while the interview is on. I'll be trying to answer the phone, 427-3772, or off-air, you can contact the Huff line, 423-HUFF, 423-4833. So, stick with us. Here we go.
Okay, it's about 4:30 in the afternoon on January. That's somewhere in there, 27th of January. And I'm here in San Francisco with author and, what do we call it, constitutional law expert, historian, Godfrey Lehman. Hi, Godfrey.
Yeah, Hi. I don't know if I'm a constitutional law expert, but I know a little bit of something about it.
I would say you know quite a bit about it. You've written a number of books. We have in front of us Grand Jury Trials of History, We the Jury, The Impact of Jurors on Our Basic Freedoms, which is a hardbound book, which is, what is this, your third or fourth book that you've written?
It's the third book. Yeah, my third published book.
And the other two have been on similar subjects. You've written about Bushell's case, the man who...
Well, I wrote a fictionalized version of the greatest jury trial in history. I call it The Ordeal of Edward Bushell. Mm-hmm. Edward Bushell was the strongest juror. He wasn't the foreman. Strongest juror on a freedom of religion case. It took place in 1670. And I regard Edward Bushell, in a certain sense, as the father of our country. What I mean by that is we live in a republic, and the strength of a republic is in the people, not in its leaders. And Edward Bushell was just a man of the people. Well, actually, he was a little bit corrupt himself, because he'd raised himself from extreme poverty to very great wealth in the 17th century, and you probably couldn't do that without doing a little shady business. He had his own business, but when he went on the jury, he led the jury. He had his conscience, as it happens to most jurors, got him, and he was the strongest man. And he led the jury in the freedom of religion case. The law said you had to be a member of the Anglican Church. The defendant said was worshiping a different religion, nothing more radical than a different interpretation of the Protestant Bible, not even Catholicism.
And we might even say that this was William Penn.
Well, I was going to put that at the end.
Oh, whoops, right. Sorry. Ah, no, I exposed it for you. But this took place in an England in which there'd been a lot of religious division and dissension, and you were supposed to contribute to the majority church, the Anglican Church, and all other church services were forbidden, and the Quakers were meeting on the steps of the church, because they weren't allowed to do their services in church, right?
Well, it was a Sunday, August 14, 1670, and they couldn't get into the church. It was locked and barred, and soldiers were guarding it, not allowing to get in. So the Quakers, being peaceable people, they wouldn't rush the soldiers. Says, well, okay, so we invite you to join with us. If you don't let us get in, then it's Sunday, it's the Lord's Day. We'll have our services right here as close to the church as we can get. So we held the services right on the steps in front of the church. You see, and the soldiers arrested them. They took them all to prison. They released all the members of the congregation except William Penn and a colleague, William Meade. That was August 14, 1670, and they brought them to trial.
How long before they were taken to trial?
Well, the only good thing was it was very quick. It didn't go on for years. They went to trial then in September. Wait a minute, I got my dates mixed up here. Just a minute.
Wasn't it 1672? That's what
1670 was the trial.
Was
August 14th. Yeah, and then he was arrested on September 5th. And he went to trial. That's right. The trial came very quickly afterward. Mm-hmm. By a jury that the court tried to handpick, and then they tried to impress upon them that they had to convict, because all they were supposed to determine is whether or not they violated the law, and they were not to judge the law. The law said you had to be an Anglican. And Penn not only admitted that, they told him, well, he admitted that, so you have to find him guilty.
He admitted that he wasn't an Anglican, right?
Well, he admitted that he was conducting a Quaker service,
right,
in violation
of the Conventicle Act.
Yeah, and so the judges told him. The chief judge was the Lord Mayor of London, Sir Samuel Starling. He told him, well, all you have to do is determine whether he violated the law. He says he did, therefore you must convict. You cannot evaluate the law. So the jury, they couldn't accept this. So they went in. Ordinarily they'd be going for about 10 minutes and come back with a guilty verdict. The jury didn't come back for a while until the court decided bring them down. Well, eight came down and four didn't. So they said, well, you can't have a verdict, just eight. You had to go up there and deliberate again. So they did that, and finally the 12 came down. They asked for the verdict. So the foreman got up, his name was Thomas Vere, and said that William Penn was guilty of speaking on Grace Church Street. Now, they said they're forced to say guilty. So the guilty was speaking, and the court got angry at them. So you can't say that. There's no law against speaking. Was he guilty of violating the other law? He says, no, all I have in my commission, he was guilty of speaking on Grace Church Street. So the court wouldn't accept that, so they sent him back up to the jury room again. This was a Saturday. And the jury came down again and said, guilty of speaking on Grace Church Street. So they locked him up.
They locked up the jury.
Overnight. And they didn't. And they decided to have a Sunday meeting. Because they figured they couldn't keep their fit when they were there without food, water, light, or heat, or even access to the most elementary forms of plumbing. The trial record said that the jury room became badly fouled. You can imagine what that meant. So they came down Sunday when it was a hot September day. They came down Sunday, sort of flies and maggots are gathering. They came down Sunday morning, they asked for the verdict. The foreman, Thomas Rea, stands up and says, guilty of speaking on Grace Church Street. And the enraged was caught. They sent him back up to the jury room again. He said, we'll go up again, but that's going to be our verdict, the same thing. They went up, and they did that several times till about the middle of Sunday afternoon. The court was too exasperated. They locked him up again the second night without light, heat, or in a now a badly fouled jury room. The trial record says that somehow people got food to them. Now, in my book, which I call The Ordeal of Edward Bushell, I do a lot of fictionalization there and carry them through. And I also have imaginary scenes in the jury room. The jurors, and by this time, they were becoming ill. Some were running in high fever. It came down Monday morning, and several were in high fever and like to die, according to the record. So they asked for the verdict, and the foreman stood up, and he changed his verdict. He said, what is your verdict? He says, is William Penn guilty? He says, he just said, not guilty. As far as William Meade, the second one, says, not guilty. Now, these were positive verdicts. They had to accept those verdicts. And the court, well, they had to accept them at this time, but then they decided to punish the jurors by fining them. The fine was 40 marks. The best I could figure that out, it was equivalent to maybe about half a year's salary for an ordinary working man, a terribly high fine. So some of the jurors managed to come up with paying it through the help of spectators, but Edward Bushell, who had enough money by this time, he could have paid for the fines for all of them, but he wouldn't pay even for himself. So he and four others who would not pay were then locked up in prison. And they were for an indefinite period. So they were put in prison. The Penn and Meade were not immediately freed because they were on another charge of, it's a minor charge. They wore their hats in the courtroom. The reason why they wore their hats in the courtroom is the court ordered them to keep their hats on. They took them off. The court said put them back on again. So they put them back on again. Then the court fines them for showing disrespect for the court for not taking them off. You get that? The guy out of prison, however, because Penn's paid fine was paid, we believe it must have been paid by his father, who was very ill at the time and actually died only a few weeks later and probably wanted Penn to come home.
We're talking about Penn, not Bushell?
William Penn was put in prison.
Right.
Well, he was put in prison for not paying the fine for removing the hats.
Right.
But apparently it was paid, see. No, Bushell remained in prison. Mm-hmm. And three others, they wouldn't pay their fines. They remained in prison now from September until November while they appealed to the Court of Common Pleas, which might be roughly considered equivalent to our Supreme Court, mm-hmm. on the habeas corpus. And the Court of Common Pleas, then on November 9th, came down with a decision. It was the first time the habeas corpus had ever been used in this case, saying that the court could not fine the jurors for going against their evidence, because by definition, only the jury knows what the evidence was. They could not fine the jury for violating the law, because in order to be able to know the law, you had to know the evidence first. So the jury knew the evidence, only the jury would know the law. So they freed them. On a habeas corpus, the jurors went free in November. They were in prison for about 9 weeks, so they went free.
And you're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, an interview with Godfrey Lehman, a constitutional scholar on jury nullification.
We're talking to Godfrey Lehman, historian and writer. He's describing the story of Edward Bushell, which he has documented in a semi-fictional, semi-factual account called...
Well, The Ordeal of Edward Bushell. Mm-hmm. No, it's a true story, but I fictionalized it. Simply, you know, I gave him the Jewish families, and I described imaginary scenes in the jury room. There's no record of what went on. But the basic elements, it is true. It did happen. And when the jury acquitted William Penn, of course, they nullified the law, the Conventicle Act, requiring everybody to be an Anglican. But then, of course, the court wasn't through with them, and they tainted the jurors and put them in prison. And they were in prison then for 9 weeks.
In those days, jurors did not give the verdict that the judge wanted to be put in jail, right?
Well, of course, yes. Well, I mean, judges can be pretty hard on jurors today. They don't bring in the verdict that the jurors want. We don't have a true jury trial in this country. We don't at all. The only extent that we have it is to accept the jurors rebel against the judges. What you have to understand as a juror is that you are the highest position in the courtroom. Your rank is higher than the judge. And you have the right to do anything you want to. The only control the judge has over you as a juror is to require you to come in the courtroom at a stated time and go in the jury box and listen. But that's all, quite obviously, because your rank is higher. You see, the judge's rank, the judge gets his position from the Constitution. The Constitution is written by we the people. The jurors are we the people. So they are above. They're not actually controlled by the Constitution in this respect. The only control the government has over the people is to prevent us from harming one another. But they cannot control us in the operation of our private lives in any respect. So the jurors are higher. Now the jurors have the right to nullify, which means they can overrule the law as written. The reason being the law is written by the legislature. And the legislature is also servants of the people. They're our servants. The servants of the people who are the sovereigns. And if the sovereigns don't care, the sovereign means it's the highest power there is. If they don't like the law, then they can overturn it. But of course, you can say, well, they can do it, you know, just by whim, but jurors basically don't do that. The 12 of them have to agree that the law isn't any good. And in this case, in the case of William Penn, the law said you had to worship in the Anglican Church. The jury says, no, we don't like that law. They all agreed. So they called him not guilty, simply because they overruled the law. This can be done today. That comes from the fact that we are sovereign. It's not a power that's given to us by the Constitution or anything like that. We are sovereign, and therefore we can do anything we want to do as long as we just show respect for one another. So when the judge tells you that you have to take the law from him, you can, well, figuratively speaking, at least you wouldn't do it in the courtroom, thumb your nose at him. You can just say, well, thank you, judge, but I'm the sovereign. You wouldn't have to say that, you just have to recognize it. And if I don't like the law, then we'll go over it. Of course, jurors aren't going to act on it. I mean, there are always some individual cases, naturally. But you have to get 12 of them, and if two or three of them, you know, are one going to act on whim, it's not going to do much good. You have to convince the others. And in any group of 12, you're going to get a mixture of people. You'll always get maybe two or three people who are overly responsible and a great sense of duty or something, and you might have some on the other end. But the mixture that you get in there, the jury tends to elevate you. It's the only time you have much any real power. And I have a corollary to this that's what was his name, who said in the 19th century, power tends to corrupt and all...
Lord Acton.
Lord Acton. Power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
However, when power is shared by people who are basically intimidated by it and do not seek it, and held for a short time, it tends to ennoble. And that's what happens on the jury. You can't have so-called professional juries that would defeat the idea of the jury. Because if you had the same jurors time after time again, well, then they would become inured and they'd start to abuse their power. But you're on a jury once or twice or maybe three times, or particularly scattered over the years, you tend not to do it, you know, and this is the record. This has been the record of history all the way from the very, very beginning. It goes all the way back to the days of Greece and the earliest history. What they had in Greece wouldn't be juries as we call them today, but it was a form of it. You know, they'd have these so-called, like Socrates, which is the most famous one. He was tried before 501 Athenian citizens.
A huge jury chosen by lot, right?
Well, mostly, yeah. Now, some of their juries were as low as 2,001. The reason for the extra one, you can imagine, is because they wouldn't come out even in the vote. And you simply listen to the case and then vote it by dropping a tablet in one box, guilty or not guilty. And the majority, if the majority won, that would be the verdict. Well, it missed out on the most important part. The most important part of a jury is the intra-jury room discussion, where the jurors get together and hammer it out. And the more conscientious jurors, of course, usually tend to elevate the least conscientious, who want to look good, at least. And that's the most important part of the trial. And there's very little record of that. And because, like in Socrates' case, which is the most famous one, there were 501. He was convicted by a vote of about 30 votes out of 500, something like that. Well, they had the discussion in the jury room, very easily, you know, there would have been a switch of 15 or 16 votes very easily, and he wouldn't have been convicted. But this was they didn't understand that then. But later on, it's the jury history is a little bit vague and, you know, uncertain. But when it started to develop into the more or less the modern form around the 12th century, with the 12, then of course, then for a time, the jurors were the same as the witnesses. You know, you'd select the jurors according to those who knew most about the case, which has a certain rationale to it. But now, of course, they try to bring in jurors who knew absolutely nothing. And you can't go by. Well, that isn't the most important part. The most important part is that then they put them through this selection process, which violates the Constitution and also violates the jury principle. The current jury is selected the attempt is to stack the jury with a proper bias.
You're talking about a voir dire?
Well, the voir dire process, and also more than that, they have professional detective agencies that do secret spying on the jurors, you know, in private, and turn all these dossiers to the prospective attorneys. They try to get their names, they can get them, and they'll spend a lot of money just investigating the jurors. And then they go into the voir dire process, which means, it's the process whereby they make inquiry into jurors' private lives. They ask them, first of all, to fill out questionnaires, which the jurors don't have to do. And they have to answer questions on the voir dire.
Now, have you heard of a jury in California refusing to fill out a questionnaire and seen the consequences of that?
Well, there haven't been many who've done that. The last time that I was on, I simply filled out the basic information, my name, address, and phone number, and indicated that I was over the age of 18, and I was younger than death. They didn't do anything about that. When we went to court, it was several years ago. It's a little difficult for me to get called now because of illness at home. It requires my... But the last time I was there, the judge asked me some questions and I refused to answer them. And voir dire. So then she ordered me out of the jury box and I refused to go. So she had six bailiffs to come. Six bailiffs came. When they got to me, well, I got up and walked out because they would have picked me up and I couldn't bear being touched by them. And I figured I'd achieved, you know, so I just I walked out with them. Mm-hmm. I couldn't. And then she wanted to put me in prison.
Who was the judge?
Oh, Judge Ali Marie Victoire.
Really?
Yeah. So she wanted to put me in prison. She said to me, when I invoked, it said by the Constitution, they didn't have to do that. She said, you invoked your constitutional rights and went straight to the county jail. Now, think of this. To invoke the Constitution, you're considered a criminal. You know, so you can't go to the jail for invoking the Constitution. What's the Constitution for? Then she talks about constitutional rights. Well, there's no such thing as a constitutional right. Are you aware of this?
Tell me.
Well, you see, our rights do not come from the Constitution. They come from a much higher authority.
The people.
Well, no, they come from a higher authority than that. They come from, well, up there. Whatever you want to, you know, I don't want to get into a religious discussion here, but they come from the highest authority that exists. They come by matter of birth. You have all powers, the Constitution declares. All powers are inherent in the people. Well, it says all powers are inherent in the people. It says all rights are inherent in the people. All means all, exactly that. Rights are inherent means you get them because you're born. They're inherent in the people. They're not given to. All the Constitution says it enumerates certain rights. See, when the Constitution was written, there was no Bill of Rights at first. And they didn't want to write a Bill of Rights, some of the people, because if you write the Bill of Rights, it's going to be misinterpreted. It's going to mean that you either have to mention every single right that exists, because you only mention some of them, then people will think the ones that are not mentioned are not the people's rights, which is exactly what has happened. You see, if you don't mention a right, if you don't mention a right, it's the figure isn't there. But all rights are inherent. But they insisted upon it, so they wrote 10 amendments. The 10th amendment, in effect, says just because it isn't mentioned in the Constitution doesn't mean it exists. It doesn't exist. All rights are inherent in the people. Mm-hmm. And if you look, the Bill of Rights doesn't give anybody any rights. When you read it, you know, it's a Bill of Rights written negatively. It doesn't say the people shall have freedom of speech. It says Congress cannot take it away. And so they shall have freedom of religion. It says Congress cannot take away their freedom of religion. All of them are written negatively, except the two jury amendments, which are written a little bit differently. But the rest of them all say the government cannot take away any rights from the people. And this isn't understood. So there's no such thing as a constitutional right. The judges, even the Supreme Court judges and the chief judge, talk about constitutional rights. They talk about that, they don't know the Constitution. All rights are inherent in the people. And those words, in that respect, well, that isn't actually in the federal Constitution. It's in several state constitutions, but it's in a different way. But in effect, it means all rights are inherent in the people by birth. So when the jurors are there, it also says all powers are inherent in the people. So the jurors have all the powers, and they have the power then to write the law and to change the law as written by their servants, our servants, the legislators. And when jurors do that, probably in the overwhelming, there are always naturally exceptions here and there. But jurors are very, as I say, are very conscientious. They don't like the law. That's the record of his, all our rights, the Bill of Rights and all our rights have been recognized by juries. In this case, they recognize the right of freedom of religion. There's another case, the trial of John Peter Zenger, which was placed in 1734. And when he simply published a newspaper that the government didn't approve of, and the jurors acquitted him, because all rights are inherent in the people, and the jurors did away with slavery. I contend that slavery would have ended without a civil war. Just give it a little time. It ended in, see, slavery, there was slavery in the North up until only a very few years before the Civil War began, but it ended by jury verdict. So I studied this. In fact, one of the chapters in my book, called what's the book called?
We the Jury?
No, the other one. Well, as a matter of fact, it's in this book too, yeah. We the Jury. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it tells about the slavery trials, and the jurors in the North, particularly in Massachusetts, outlawed slavery. Slavery was outlawed by a jury verdict in a series of notable four cases involving the same slave between 1780 and 1783. In 1783, slavery was outlawed totally in Massachusetts. Now, the records will show that the slaves existed in Massachusetts for maybe 20 or 30 years more, but they were, you might say, voluntary slaves. You know, it's much easier sometimes to be a slave than to be free. Because when you're a slave, all your needs are taken care of, and your master makes decisions for you. That's easier sometimes than going out into the open market and having to get a job. So people who are older people who probably were enslaved said, well, my master's kindly to me, I'll just stay along and be a slave.
Are you speculating on this, or do you have any actual...
Well, because slaves are... when you study the population, it shows that there were slaves in Massachusetts after 1783, mm-hmm. dwindling. But they were voluntary, because you didn't... You know, they just, but anybody who didn't want to be a slave just could up and leave, and they couldn't do anything about it.
And did that happen in great numbers, or?
Well, it happened. You see, it happened. The cases that I wrote about. Of course, remember some of the historical records aren't very clear. But this is a series about a slave called Quack Walker was his name. He had four trials, and he was a slave, and he was encouraged by some neighbors who were against slavery. He says, you know, Quack, you don't have to be a slave. In effect, the Massachusetts Constitution already indicated all men are free and equal. And the jury was asked, does that apply to blacks as well as whites? And the jury said, yes, it does. So they encouraged Quack Walker to go over their farm, and they worked for him as a free man. He was kidnapped and brought back to the farm of his owners, and that's how the cases arose. And the jury said that he was a free man. And so it ended there. Now, but in the South, there's also evidence by that juries who are bringing in verdicts, anti-slavery verdicts, more than you might, and you'd be amazed the number of anti-slavery verdicts brought in by white male jurors in the South. And I do believe, I can't prove it, that if there hadn't been a civil war, they just done in the South, that we had a slavery verdict down there by jury verdict, maybe within, I can't say how long, 5, 8, maybe 2, maybe 10 years, without a civil war.
Now, in San Francisco, you've given this dramatic account of how you yourself refused to answer any other than the most elementary questions when you were on a jury, and how you were punished for it, or they tried to punish you for it. Have you observed much jury process here in San Francisco?
Well, it's pretty much the same when they go through this procedure. I have a little difficulty sometimes because I don't have the time, you know, to do as much as I would like. I could do a great deal more, but frankly, I have a financial problem I have to keep, and I'm working at a job, so
You're also full-time taking care of someone who needs to be taken
care of. Well, also, yes, I have Mrs. Lehman has Alzheimer's and requires either full-time help for her just for me to get away. See?
And you're also working on trying to get research done to publish a second volume of investigations into the jury.
I'm working, it's my fourth book. Yeah. See, my first book was What You Need to Know for Jury Duty. My second was the fictionalization of the Bushell trial. The third was this We the Jury, which is not fictionalized. It takes 12 highly significant trials, or groups of related trials, like the slavery trials, you see, or the witchcraft trials, and shows the jury response to them. And it shows the jurors, both on their vanguard, for the most part, well, they are, basically, when they're free and independent, they advance our liberties. They're always so-called bad jury verdicts, but I analyze them, that's when the jury falls under control of the court, some way or other, you see. And now the book I'm working on now, which I call Is This Any Way to Run the Jury, is a certain extension of We the Jury, but also an analysis of why we have so many convicted, or part of it deals with convicting the innocent. Why do jurors convict innocent people? Well, mostly it is not the jury's fault. One thing I do know this, from a study is made that when jurors and judges bring in verdicts, a study was made at the University of Chicago in which the judge was asked the verdict by the researchers before the jury board did what they had done, and they found that the judges would have convicted about 25% of the time more frequently than the juries would. They agreed about 75%. But when they disagreed, the judges would have convicted where the juries would have, where the juries did acquit. So if you do that, if judges were convicted those trials, then you'd have 25% more convicted innocents. Now, a lot of the time the convicted innocence is because the trial system is utterly corrupt. I mean, there are an amazing number of cases where prosecutors and judges themselves will bring in perjured evidence, which the jury will hear.
Can you give us some cases of that?
Well, of course, the Simpson trial was used as an example. When there's perjured evidence, let me see, right off my head, I can't think there. Wait a minute, you asked me to name some cases. It's a little hard now to think of particular cases, but I know that it happens very often when the prosecutor, in fact, one of the students of this that I've been studying has recommended that when a prosecuting attorney allows and encourages introduction of perjured evidence and getting the witnesses to lie, that the prosecutors should be themselves prosecuted and brought to trial, which isn't being done, so they can get away with it. They do that, the jurors are fooled by this. Then also, the jurors in the selection process are hand-picked so as to try to stack the jury with pro-conviction bias to begin with, and without not getting all the evidence. So, and the fact that, most of the time when a jury brings in a verdict of conviction, particularly when the defendant is not guilty, an appeal is made to higher courts. Well, more frequently than not, the higher courts will, say, uphold the jury verdict, which means that the judges, who should be wiser, presumably, and probably get additional information the jury didn't have, they're just supporting the conviction, the false conviction. And it's very hard sometimes to get even after a defendant has been shown to be not guilty, sometimes they keep him in prison for a long time, even then it's hard to get him out.
Yeah, I've noticed that. We're talking to Godfrey Lehman, author, historian, and activist, I would have to say. Even in spite of the limited time now that you're able to devote to this. I know you're looking to get support for your next book and publication of that book. Is there, I guess if anybody there is interested in the jury particularly, copies of Godfrey's book can be obtained from him in San Francisco. Give a call to 423-HUFF, 423-4833. That's the local number for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. I will give you his address. He's going to give it to you now, but if you don't have a pencil and paper present and you want to get his address later, just call 423-HUFF. Go ahead.
Well, I'll give you my address, but the book We the Jury is available in the bookstores. Uh-huh. And the earlier book, The Ordeal of Edward Bushell, may not be immediately available. Of course, the large stores like Barnes & Noble and things like that, which have everything, may have it, but they will always order it for you. The first book what you need to know for jury duty probably is not actually in the bookstores at this time, but they can get it. Mm-hmm. Now, the one I'm working on is just a way to run the jury. Actually, this is where I'm a little bit stymied because of the need for the home care and everything like that. But I am making slow progress on it. And I haven't got it as a publisher committed to it yet, but I do have an agent working on it.
And if you're interested in these books and you can't find them in bookstores, do give a call to 423-4833, and I will get you in touch with Godfrey, who can, I presume, get you copies of the books for...
Is that 415?
No, that's area code 431, actually. Oh. We're actually here in San Francisco with this interview, but this will be played on free radio in Santa Cruz. Mm-hmm. Any parting words? I'm about to collapse in a heap here. I give you in a heap. I think the whole issue of jury nullification is very important on a number of fronts, including the drug war, unpopular and unconstitutional wars, commitment of people for so-called mental illness reasons, conservatorships, and also in the cases of homeless activists who are harassed under unjust laws. But I haven't got the time to ask you these questions. Now I'm hoping I can get you to come back on the air at another time, maybe in another phone interview.
Well, I'd be glad to do that. I'm always just talking about the jury. I regard the jury as basically the only honor.
2-4-2, vote for me, and I'll set you free.
And at last, the long-awaited Merlin selection has been played. Temptation's famous Fall of Buyers and Mall of Fire. It's a Temptation song. Merlin, dig it. Today is April 1st. About to leave the air back on Thursday at 7 o'clock.
Segregation, determination, demonstration, integration, aggravation, humiliation, obligation to my nation.
Coffee Roasting Company in an hour. Join me and Steve Argy. Sleepy Man on the next. 1649 April 1st. Digger directed by St. George Hill. Taking land to plant in common. And more as well. But there's no time for it. Thank you for being with us. Now stay tuned for that.
Evolution, revolution, gun control, sound.
Cut your hair and get a fucking job.
Politicians say more taxes will solve everything.